Thank you for the invitation. Andrea asked me to speak about the basic concepts, so I apologize to those who are in the area. Nati can walk and have coffee. Pauline as well. I will go slowly, but I'm not exactly sure what people are comfortable with and what they're not comfortable, so please feel free to interrupt at any point. I'm going to go through some very basic concepts and put them in the perspective of some questions in neural networks, which is, I guess, one of the motivations for this workshop. So I have too much stuff. We'll just cut at some point. I was planning to talk about, motivate the problem, discuss the statistical learning setup, give an example of linear classifiers, which is just a one-layer neural network, talk about the bias variance trade-off, talk about the uniform deviations approach to proving that an algorithm generalizes or works well. I want to talk about memorization regime, which is something that's quite interesting that came out recently, and there are quite a few people focusing on this topic now, and discuss what is overfitting. Okay, so let me start. This is a feed-forward neural network. If you haven't seen it, it's just some input vector X gets multiplied by a matrix that sends it to another vector, and then we apply a coordinate-wise nonlinearity, such as just a max between the coordinate and zero. Then multiply by another matrix, apply nonlinearity, multiply by another matrix, and so forth. The depth of this neural network, L, is just the number of times you multiply by a matrix. W's are tunable parameters of this neural network, and so the aim is to tune these matrices W in this non-convex landscape as to find a good fit to data. When we're fitting data, you can talk about regression, where you're fitting real-valued outcomes or classification. This is a classification objective that you would typically write down. This is the empirical loss, so having data xi, yi, and I will discuss in more detail the kind of the statistical approach to this problem. Xi, yi are the data, let's say images, and the labels of whether this is a cat or a dog. One aims to optimize some kind of objective function like this. This is called logistic loss or cross-entropy loss. Okay, so this is a non-convex problem, and an optimization procedure often succeeds in optimizing this objective function, and what people are trying to figure out is why does it succeed, because the landscape is pretty crazy, or maybe not so crazy as some people think. Okay, so there are several questions regarding the setup that people ask. Yes, there is a question.
Can you just comment why you choose the cross-entropy loss and not the mean squared error?
You can choose the mean squared error. Not much will change. There are some differences, but many of the phenomena already appear in the square loss. So we can think of square loss and think of y's as just plus one minus one real values and optimized square loss. But this gives slightly better performance, and that's what people use in practice.
You don't have reasons to choose this one, right?
We don't have reasons to choose. Yes?
Just a real question. Is there a difference between capital X and small kx? And what is just real component vector? Or?
Yeah, so X is a real component vector. Y is a binary output, plus one, minus one. The function f is parameterized in this way.
So capital X and small kx is the same?
Yeah. These will be the random variables in a few slides. Okay. So there are three questions essentially that people study in this setup. One is the question of generalization. If you optimize this objective with empirical data, cats, dogs, let's say images, why is it the case that the solution performs well on other images? Okay. So that's a question of generalization. Another question is a question of optimization. Why can we find some good solutions to this objective, or squared loss objective is fine. So why can we find good objective, good solutions, even though this is a non-convex problem? And third question of approximation theory style, what is the expressive power? What types of functions can we approximate using these functions? Okay, so these are different functions, and I will only talk about generalization. Okay, the problem is it's difficult to talk about generalization if you don't have a handle on optimization, because you don't know where the solution is. But let me just give some basic tools with which people study generalization. Okay, so there's a lot of hype, perhaps rightfully so in some cases. The data set here is a data set of images, and it's about 60,000 images. And people take neural networks with 2 million parameters, or roughly 2 million parameters. So clearly, of course, there is a lot of dependence, and there is a structure to the neural network that I haven't described that's important. But just the raw number of parameters in this table, it's clear that these models are way over-parameterized, and the performance only gets better and better. This is the out-of-sample performance. This is from Natia's paper. You parameterize on the x-axis the number of parameters, and so with each number of parameters, that's the architecture, you run the stochastic gradient descent, you optimize that objective, and you see that the more parameters you take, essentially the better the result is, which is counterintuitive because you think of overfitting too many parameters. But something happens with the landscape where if there are enough parameters, there is enough flexibility to find a good solution. Okay. There's another result. Again, it's the same phenomenon. We're plotting training error and testing error. And they're decreasing for a while with as you increase the number of model parameters. And then at some point, you pass the number of data points, although this is not really a good comparison because the neural network has some structure, so it's not exactly the number of degrees of freedom. But once you pass this line, it seems that the expected error, the out-of-sample error is flat, it doesn't get worse as you increase the number of parameters. So something is happening with the landscape such that it's easier to find good minimizers. And I should say that it's unclear whether this worst performance here is due to the inability of smaller networks to actually find good parameters. Maybe it's a question of computation. We don't know. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, are you using plain stochastic gradient, or you have some regularization tricks?
Yeah, this is just plain stochastic gradient descent without.
The mini batch?
Yes, that's right. That's right. Yeah. Okay. Do you want to comment? Okay. So now I'm going to step out of the neural network setup and just talk about the basics of statistical learning theory. Okay. So perhaps I should have started with this. The data are tuples x1, y1, xn, yn. And they're assumed to be IID from some unknown distribution P on the product XY, okay? That's the setup. What makes a difference, and Andrea asked me to stress this to physicists, we are trying not to model, typically, the distribution P. This is different for physicists. Physicists are typically trying to write down a model as a probability distribution. Here, we're going to assume some very weak conditions on P, but we're not going to assume that, for instance, the data necessarily comes from a neural network with some noise, okay? Right. And what I want to show are mechanisms under which one can still show that the method predicts well. And the key here is that the objective is prediction. It's not estimating the parameters, right? If you're estimating the parameters, of course, you need to write down a model with parameters that you can estimate. Here, the goal is prediction. And again, everything that I'm saying is there are 100 variants, and so I'm just giving a one kind of major thrust in this area. So a learning algorithm is just a map that sends the training data to a function. And then you can use this function to predict y from x, okay? Please stop me if this is unclear. And we're not modeling the distribution xy, although we will be putting some weak assumptions on this distribution. So the goal is prediction. There is some loss function L that compares on a new example drawn from the same population, y and x. What is the performance of this our method, the estimator, in terms of what it predicts on the x, and let's compare it to the y drawn from this distribution together with x as a tuple, okay? And this is a conditionally on the data set because f hat is a random variable. And when I talk about L, this is the expected loss of our method. When I talk about this random variable being small, I mean in expectation or with high probability and so forth, okay? So the interpretation here is that we would like to achieve a small prediction error on a random example from the same population, okay? So we're given a bunch of cats and dogs labeled, and we would like on a new example to predict well. And typically this is approximated by average on a fresh test sample, but I will skip that. Let me just contrast this with the problem of estimation, where we would like to estimate the, let's say, regression function, the some parameter in some norm, and this is a slightly different objective, okay? So you might be interested in estimating the regression function, which is the expected y given x in some kind of norm, and that is more in the purview of statistics nonparametric estimation. Although I should say that for square loss, there is a connection between these two problems if you take the norm to be L2px with respect to the marginal distribution. Okay? Just philosophically, yes? So this is a loss. If it's a cats dogs problem, it would be an indicator whether this is correct or not.
Okay, it's not the loss that we were discussing before. That you wanted to use
both the lines. Right. So there is a difference between how you measure, and sometimes people call this error, and that one loss. I will often refer to either one as loss. Okay. Good question. Thank you. So just philosophically, why not estimate the underlying distribution? Because that's the first thing that people would like to do when facing this problem. For instance, one could estimate the class conditional distributions, P of X given a label. But if the goal is prediction, then this is an overkill, and that's pretty clear, right? For prediction, you just need to figure out the boundary between classes, let's say the boundary between the cats and dogs. You don't really care about the specifics about these two of these two distributions, and in fact, there are many distributions that will give rise to the same decision boundary. So it's an overkill to go out and try to estimate these distributions. Okay, questions? Okay. So what is the best you can do? If you've chosen your loss function, let's say it's an indicator of a mistake, then the Bayes optimal function, this Bayes doesn't really refer to the Bayes from the Bayesian statistics. This is the minimal over all decision rules that map x to y, and we look at the expected loss, okay? The Bayes error is just the noise level, right? This is the noise level. Think of this as a square loss. Then this is just just integrated sigma squared, right? Of course, we cannot calculate any of these quantities because the distribution is unknown. And so the question is, can we get close to this Bayes error? Can we produce a method that gets us close to this noise level L of F star? Questions? Right, so depending on which loss function you take for evaluation, you can write down in a more succinct form what these Bayes errors are, or the Bayes functions are. So for a classification with 0, 1, it's just an indicator of whether the regression function expected y given x is above 1/2. That's the best thing you can do. Again, you cannot compute this. And for regression, it is exactly the expected y given x. That's the Bayes, the Bayes solution. Okay, so the most basic thing you would like is consistency. That is, as n increases, you would like to approach the best possible that you can do over all measurable functions, right? This is a very weak notion, and the good news is that it's very easy to do. With some minimal assumptions, you can get a consistent procedure. The bad news is, in general, there is no non-trivial rate that you can that you can establish here. Rate of convergence in terms of n. That's right. Unless we place some stronger assumptions on the distribution. Okay. There are so-called no free lunch theorems that establish that there is no non-trivial rate for this convergence. You pick any decreasing sequence with n, and there will be a distribution such that you can't go to Bayes faster than that decreasing. So the goal one of the goals in statistical learning is to identify weak and reasonable, whatever that means, assumption on the underlying distribution p that still yields rates in terms of n for this difference, right? Again, this is a random variable, so in expectation or in high probability. And one thing to keep in mind is that in neural networks, the model typically grows with number of data points as well. So this is a high-dimensional regime where given a set of data, a person tries to fit a model that's, let's say, 10 times larger than the data set. This is a heuristic that people use. Okay, so what about generalization? So this is really a term that's used in different ways. Generalization in the literature can refer to either the expected loss, expected performance of the procedure. It can also refer to what we want, which is the expected loss minus the noise level, right? Minus the best you can do. But sometimes it also refers to expected loss minus the empirical loss of the solution, right? And this is, for neural networks, this is typically zero or very small. So when I put a hat on L, that's the 1 over n sum of the losses of the model. And clearly this is a biased estimate of this, because the function f hat n depends on the data, and then you're evaluating it on the data. Right. These results of the third type are typically kind of a posteriori interpretable, in the sense that if you show that this is small and you observe a posteriori that this is small in practice, then you're happy because out of sample performance is good as well. Right. Any questions at this point? Okay, so what I'm going to do now is I'm going to illustrate some of the concepts that I just described on the example of linear classifiers, which is the most basic thing you can imagine. Okay, so let's go on. Let me introduce a notion of a margin. So let's assume that data live on a Euclidean sphere in some space, in d-dimensional space. The labels are plus minus 1, and let's take the indicator loss of whether the y response is equal to the to this coordinate. The margin with respect to a sequence of data, and here I'm taking any sequence of length t, is going to be the max over unit directions minimum of the product, right? So think of w times xi, just deciding whether you're on this side of the hyperplane or on the other side of the hyperplane, and then you're looking at whether that correlates with the yi. So if this is positive for all examples, then the data can be linearly separated. The pluses and the minuses can be linearly separated, okay? If this is negative, then there is no margin. There is no way to tilt the hyperplane such that it separates the pluses and the minuses. And then we just set it to be zero in that case, okay? So this is called margin, and we'll also talk about margin in the distribution, and that's almost surely for any xi, yi drawn from that distribution, almost surely you have a non-zero margin, okay? Okay, so here is a claim. When I write capital L01, what this means is the expected performance on the new xy pair with respect to the 0-1 loss. So I'm just indicating that's the indicator loss that I'm studying, okay? So the claim is that there are several procedures that enjoy what we want, the generalization error or whatever, this gap, being smaller than 1 over n, that's the rate, times expected inverse squared margin, okay? This is the claim. So is the picture clear? We have points, pluses, minuses, they live on a sphere, there's a hyperplane, we're looking at the margin, the inverse of the margin squared, and we're saying that if in the population, if the distribution is such that this is a, well, not infinity, if the margin is not zero, then we get an interesting 1 over n rate, right? And again, note that we didn't model the class conditional distribution, we didn't model the anything in this problem. The only mild assumption, well, I don't know, maybe you say that it's not a mild assumption, but the assumption is that the classes are separated by some gamma, okay? Just a couple of remarks before I move on. First of all, this is zero because there is a W star hyperplane that perfectly separates the data, let's say, in both in the population and in the sample. The result is dimension independent. Dimension D never explicitly appears here, except for, well, in the margin implicitly, but not explicitly, right? So this is a dimension independent result. And the difficulty here is essentially in this margin. And also there exists an extension which I will not discuss to, or briefly discuss, to non-zero, non-separable case when there is a hyperplane that does pretty well, but not zero. Okay. Again, just to stress this point, the assumption is not about a parametric or non-parametric form of the distribution, but rather about what happens at the boundary, at the decision boundary. Right? Again, because the target is classification, prediction, we care about what happens at the boundary and not any particularities of the distribution outside of the boundary. Okay, so if you haven't seen this, there will be talks, I believe, this week on the perceptron. So here's a talk, here's a kind of a setup for the perceptron. This is a very old, perhaps the first learning mechanism after Gauss, maybe, after linear regression. You have pairs x1, y1, xt, yt. They live on, let's say, a unit Euclidean ball and labeled by plus minus 1. We're going to maintain a hyperplane, a hypothesis, and we're going to update it iteratively over time. At each next step on round t, we're going to consider the next tuple, xt, yt. We're going to form a prediction of given the current hypothesis, is this on the plus side or the minus side? If this prediction is correct, we don't do anything. We don't update the hyperplane. If the prediction is incorrect, then we update the hyperplane by tilting it towards this example, right? This is an algorithm proposed in 50-something, 59. You can kind of see that this is a gradient descent style or stochastic gradient descent style algorithm. In 62, Novikov proved, and it's really a three-line proof, that perceptron makes at most gamma inverse squared mistakes or corrections, because the only time it corrects is when it makes a mistake, on any sequence of examples with margin gamma. All right, so this is a very strong result that says no matter how you design your sequence, how you shuffled it, how you assign the labels, as long as the margin is gamma, it will converge in a finite time with that many mistakes. Okay? Yeah, so I will give two examples now, two corollaries. In one of them, T will be equal to N. The other one, it will not be. So I just defined it for T so that we're not confused with the little n. Yeah, that's right, that's right.
We are looking for the scaling in N, but now the number of data points is capital T.
Let me give the next example and then you'll see the difference. Okay, so here's a simple consequence of this 1960 result. If the data are actually IID, not arbitrary, but IID, and let's take T to be equal to N, and you run once through the sequence, only once, then if you choose a index uniformly from this 1 through N, then the expected 0-1 loss is at most 1 over N, and then expected gamma inverse squared, okay? This is essentially a one-line consequence of that result, okay? Again, I didn't subtract the Bayes error because the Bayes error in this case is zero. Here's the second one, which is more interesting. Cycle through the data repeatedly until you make no more mistakes. And so T is at most N gamma inverse squared. The claim is that the final hyperplane of the perceptron, first it separates the data perfectly, that's clear. That is, it finds what's called an empirical risk minimizer. It minimizes the empirical 0-1 loss. There are no more mistakes. And it has the same guarantee. You can put n plus 1 here if you wish, but 1 over n. Okay, this is a bit more interesting. There is a very cute three-line proof, but maybe you can come after the talk and I will show it to you. It's really a nice proof. So what we've done actually is perceptron update can be seen as a gradient descent step on this loss function. It's a max between the YWXT and zero, right? Gradient is zero if prediction is correct, and gradient is minus YXT if it's incorrect, so we take a minus gradient step, and that's the update. And the step size is equal to one. The two consequences that I just described can be viewed as stochastic gradient descent on this objective, or the second one is a multi-pass type of optimization of this procedure, and it's guaranteed in a finite number of steps to find a minimum, right? Of course, we don't know what happens with neural networks, but for linear, it's kind of an obvious result. What's interesting is that these two give you the same results, but the paths are really different. The paths to getting this type of bound, the paths are different. One goes directly attacks kind of the expected objective. The other one attacks the empirical objective. And then there is what's called a uniform convergence result that says that if you've got the result from the empirical, and the empirical is close to expected, then the result holds for expected. Right? That's roughly what's happening under the hood. So the first result optimizes directly the expected loss. The second one optimizes the empirical loss. Okay? Any questions? Yes?
So the stochastic part is just the ordering you choose updating?
In this case, we never come back to the example, and so we can treat it as an IID draw, and so it's just a swap of the expectation and the gradient. In the second one, it's not really SGD, it's cycling, you're right. Yeah. I put quotes there. Okay, so let me just conclude this example with a few observations. So there is quite a bit of hype in the ML community about the performance of deep networks, despite A, the fact that they're overparameterized, and despite the fact that they're fitting the data perfectly. And so let's see, in the context of this example, perceptron works in infinite dimensional space. There is nothing about, there is no D that appears in the bounds, right? So at least this is already an example where the number of parameters is not the right notion of complexity. And this is well understood in statistics. The number of parameters is not necessarily the right notion, right? And in high enough dimension, any endpoints in general position can be linearly separable. And so the multi-cycle perceptron will separate them, right? So again, the simple example already shows that perfectly fitting the data doesn't necessarily contradict good generalization. It doesn't explain or predict what should happen in neural networks, and that's the downside. But at least we shouldn't just jump to conclusions that the neural networks are somehow too magical. Okay. So that concludes the linear classifiers example, and let me talk about more complex problems where we need to have a bias variance trade-off. Unless there are questions on this simple example.
Because as soon as you have non-complex devices, all this doesn't really work anymore, right?
Stochastic gradient descent, we don't know, right.
So I don't know which kind of conclusion we can really...
Yeah, so the conclusion here is just about the over-parameterization and fitting the data perfectly. And I'm just showing that there's another example where... but it's a convex problem, I agree. Okay. So bias variance trade-off. So this is the goal, which I outlined before. It's the expected loss of our algorithm minus the best possible. And if the problem is very simple, in whatever that means, we might get away with just analyzing, like in perceptron, directly this difference. However, when the problem becomes more complex, and what do I mean by problem? The set of distributions is rich enough that there are all kinds of things happening. The assumptions on P are too weak. Then we might need to stratify the space according to the space of what? The space of, let's say, solutions. So the algorithm works in by produces a function by working in some class of functions. We need to stratify this space according to some measure of complexity. Okay. So we cannot analyze this difference in one shot. We need to analyze it in two shots. So this is done in two ways in machine learning and statistics. Let's talk about the machine learning style approach. One writes down the decomposition, splits it into an estimation error, where one picks a class of functions F sub n, some class F that depends on n, and looks at the difference here, and then studies the approximation error where one needs to assume something about the F star to control this difference. Okay? This type of decomposition goes back to to the classical works in, by Vopnik and Chervaninkis and so forth. In statistics, one studies a slightly different Bayes variance decomposition. Let's talk about the square loss. So one can write down this difference as the norm in L2PX. That's what I mentioned before. That's the same thing as in expectation, this difference. And then one can split the L2PX norm with respect to the expected output of the procedure, where the expectation is taken sometimes over x and y, and sometimes just over the y1 through yn variables. That's why we have still have the expectation here. This trade-off between these two terms, or between these two terms, is typically parameterized by some tunable parameter, which is treated as a complexity. There's some complexity, such as, let's say, the number of units in the neural network, or if you're doing estimation of a function, the width of the kernel. And typically one shows that this part goes up, this part goes down. Same thing here. As you take f to be larger, this part goes up, this part goes down. Okay. Yes.
What is the physical interpretation of those two errors? Like, what does the first error, the estimation error, mean, and the approximation error mean?
So here we typically the procedure f hat n will be working inside of this class. It will be fitting the data constraint to this class. And so the richer this class is, the more difficult it becomes. And so you would expect this to go up as you take a larger class. As you take a larger class, however, you get closer to the unknown minimum over all measurable functions, right? Or if you put some constraints on F star, you get closer to that type of function. Let's say you put an assumption that this is a Sobolev, lives in the Sobolev ball, then you can try to quantify the rate at which this goes to zero. And then the result is obtained by balancing these two results. Same thing here. It's exactly the same idea. Right. This first type of approach typically goes through uniform deviation. Not always, but typically goes through uniform deviations, trying to show that uniformly over this class, again, I'm simplifying the ideas, but typically one shows that uniformly over a class, empirical averages and expected average are close for all the elements in the class, or all the functions. This one? It's not the same, right. Yeah, this is more studied in statistics rather than machine learning. So here you take your procedure and you look at the expected function output by the procedure averaged over either x's and y's, the training data, or just fixed the x and the y variables.
Yeah.
Exactly, this is the variance of the procedure. Let's say X's are actually fixed, just fixed, what's called fixed design, and only Y variables are fluctuating. Then what is the variance of your procedure, right? And this is the bias. In expectation, how close is it to what you want, the target? Does that make sense? Yes. Yeah, so the cross term is zero because this one is going to be zero. You condition on the, right, so here there is no y variables and this is zero. Conditionally on x is, this is zero, meaning the cross term goes. Okay, other questions? Okay, so this trade-off is typically parameterized by some tunable parameter that procedure needs to choose, or you do cross-validation with a fresh set of data, or some other way of estimating the parameter. And typically this parameter governs the complexity of radius, the complexity of the model. And one typically gets this type of U-shaped curve. This is the kind of a classical book from Stanford guys. As you vary that bias variance here, this tunable parameter of the procedure, the test error goes down and then goes up. Okay, so you would like to be somewhere here. On the training sample, of course, it just goes down because you typically take richer and richer models, and so the empirical fit to data can only be better and better and better. Right? And one interesting thing is that this bias variance for neural networks appears to be more complex and not well understood, and this is the topic of some of the recent papers within the last year, for instance, on this subject. Well, it depends on what you assume about F star. So if you assume that F star is a neural network with a fixed architecture, and you can get to that with some Fn, then at some point maybe you can claim that this is zero. If you do not make that assumption, it's not. But empirically, you don't know F star, so it's... The bias is in the population, so you don't know what the...
If you have image matches, one...
But you don't get zero, performance out on the fresh sample,
okay,
right?
1 billion.
I don't believe you get zero. I mean, on training you can get perfect fit, but in terms of prediction, you don't get perfect prediction. And so there is some bias. I don't know. We can discuss. And again, this curve is more difficult for neural networks because let's say you parameterize model complexity by the number of neurons, right? Then for each model, you run stochastic gradient descent and it gets to some point, and then you plot the expected and empirical. But it seems that the larger you take, that the larger model you take, the red curve just goes down, right? Which means that there is another measure of complexity, let's say L2 norm of the weights, that doesn't care about the number of parameters. Some other measure of complexity of this neural network that governs this curve, right? So it's more complicated. Okay, let me skip this. So let me talk briefly about the uniform deviation regime. When we pick this class F, and we just work with the class F and try to minimize the empirical fit to data, right? So given the training data, we try to find the best model within some class. Then it's clear that the expected performance of this empirical risk minimizer compared to the best out-of-sample performance is at most, and this can be a very loose upper bound in general, expected supremum over all functions, the expected performance of this function minus the empirical average, right? Expected minus the empirical, right? So the central limit theorem says that, or law of large numbers says that this is a small, but it's not clear that it's small when you take the supremum over a class of functions, right? So if you can show that this quantity is small, then let's call it the uniform deviation regime, because you're really saying whatever I observe on the data, that's going to be roughly my performance out of sample, right? The expected performance is going to be comparable to the empirical performance. And that's going to be, if you can establish that this is small, then it's true for all the models in your class F, and so the empirical loss is a good guidance for minimizing the expected loss, right?
Mm-hmm. I'm stuck to the previous slide.
Yeah,
so,
sure.
So I'm a bit confused by the fact that in principle, you can always make your neural network overfit. You just, let's say you do a pure gradient with a high learning rate, then you get into a local minimum and it does overfit.
Yes.
So you have to make certain type of assumption on the optimization procedure.
That's right. That's right. Right. So this is the fact that optimization procedure is such a big part of the overall picture makes it difficult to argue. Right. That's right. Okay. So let me just describe in one slide this uniform deviations approach. And so what one does, let me just change the notation a little bit. I'm going to denote z, the pair x, y by z, and the function L composed with y f of x, I'm going to call it g of z, okay, just to simplify the notation. So this is called an empirical process. It's indexed by functions g in the class g, and to each function we associate a rescaled 1 over square root of n average, right? There is another process which we're going to call Rademacher or Bernoulli process. Epsilon i's are independent symmetric plus minus 1, half-half plus minus 1. And this process can be studied for fixed z1 through zn, right? So for fixed z's, you can look at this as a Rademacher or Bernoulli process for each function g. Okay, then kind of a classical result says that the supremum, expected supremum of this process can be related to the expected supremum of this process in both directions, essentially. Okay, that's what this says. And the point here is that this is called the symmetrization step. The point is that now we can condition on the data and look at the just the behavior with respect to the random coin flips. And that gives us data-dependent measures of this uniform convergence, if you wish, data-dependent quantities. You can do covering numbers and so forth. Okay, so in the 60s, a notion of Wapnick-Chernyshenko's dimension was introduced. This is some combinatorial dimension, I'm not going to define it, some combinatorial dimension of the class, and it can be shown that the maximum of this Rademacher process can be controlled by this combinatorial complexity of the class. Okay. Now, unfortunately for neural networks, this is not enough. One can show that if you look at neural networks, fixed architecture with L layers, K parameters, and let's say ReLU activation, doesn't really matter. And you define the class F by as all the functions you can get with this architecture, right, with all the different parameters. Then the sign of F, this class, has a VC dimension of something like KL log K up to log factors. This is tight. So K times L is the VC, this combinatorial dimension of the class. K parameters, L layers. So clearly, if you put it into this result, it gives a vacuous bound because the number of parameters typically is larger, taken to be larger than the number of data points. So here you cannot apply the typical Wapnick-Chernyshenko's theory, which is pessimistic, and the VC dimension is just too large. Now here, I want to spend one slide on the margin analysis because this is not the only way to try to prove a generalization bound. Here, we're focused on the signs generated by neural networks. What kind of signs can neural networks realize? And that's just too large if the number of parameters is large. Here is what's called a margin analysis, and that essentially says the following. The 0, 1, with high probability for all functions in the class F, the 0, 1 expected error is bounded by, and this is a different loss function now, this loss function measures the errors including gamma margin errors. So even if you got the right sign, but you weren't assertive enough in the value up to gamma, then you pay this indicator, right? This is the number of gamma margin mistakes. Again, in the perceptron case, if data are separable, you would hope that this is zero. Then you pay this Rademacher averages, which is what I did, which is the supremum of that Rademacher process for classes of functions f and some term that goes to zero. So what is nice here is that you by looking at the margin, you don't have to look at the signs anymore, signs of these functions. You can look at the real valued complexity of the neural networks, right? So by looking at the scale at which neural networks make predictions and paying for gamma margin mistakes, you can now talk about complexity of the class as a class of real valued functions, not as a class of 0, 1, or minus 1, 1 valued functions, okay? So here's the example. If you look at the class of linear functions with a L2 norm constraint, and let's say Xi's are also bounded in the Euclidean norm by 1, then this Rademacher averages are bounded by the radius divided by square root of n. And again, this result is dimension independent. And so if you plug it in here, you would get essentially an analog with a worst rate, an analog of the perceptron result that I showed earlier, right? Because there would be this term would be 0, this term would be 1 over gamma, 1 over square root of n. So up to the square that we lost, it's the perceptron result, right? Okay, so it would be nice if we could define for neural networks some notion of a ball. So what is a ball in the space of neural networks? Well, one can take different things, and they're not necessarily dominating one another. Here's one suggestion. Take the Frobenius norms of the weight matrices and just add them up, right? So this is one complexity of a neural network. Now, the issue here that was pointed out by many people in the last 5 years is that this is a bad notion because of the scale invariance. So imagine you take a neural network with a ReLU activation. There is a positive homogeneity. You can rescale one layer and rescale another layer down. The function doesn't change, but the sum of the L2 norms changes. And so for the same function, you would get different measures of complexity. This is not a necessarily a good notion. So another try is the product of Frobenius norms, and you can go to different ones. There are several papers by Nati here in the audience that studied different notions of complexity of neural networks. You can put some Shatten norm here, spectral norm, and so forth. So let me just mention one result by Golovich et al. In 2018 for a class of neural networks with bounded product of the weight matrices. If they're bounded by B, then these Rademacher averages are bounded above by B over n to the 1/4. I'm losing log factors here, and B square root of the depth of the neural network divided by square root of n. So it's almost what we had for perceptron. Remember, for perceptron, we got B over square root of n, right? And once again, if we go through the Wapnick-Chervenenkis route of looking at all the possible signs that we can realize by a hyperplane, then dimensionality of the space will enter. If we go through this type of margin bound where we look at the real valued functions, then we can get away with a complexity that doesn't depend on the dimensionality of the space. Okay. Again, this is going back to what are the appropriate notions of complexity for neural networks. Okay. But of course, there is no reason to believe, at least we don't know, as far as I know, whether SGD on neural networks controls this measure of complexity. Okay, so this is purely an attempt to prove something, to show some kind of uniform convergence over a ball of neural networks. such that empirical values are close to the expected values. But whether the stochastic gradient descent optimizes that complexity is not clear. Okay?
This complexity has nothing to do with the nonlinearities, right?
Exactly, right.
Yeah. So it's actually maybe correct for a deep linear network?
No, but it works even with nonlinearities. It works, so the complexity doesn't have the sigmas, but the result applies to neural networks with sigmas. That's right. As long as that those sigmas are Lipschitz. Yes?
So you're talking about the complexity of the network, not the complexity of the landscape, aren't you?
That's right.
Because for the underlying landscape for small systems, you can get a frustration index for that if you're able to calculate the complete network. And that's quite insightful, but it might be possible for something in a million variables.
Yeah, so this is purely an example of how the tools in statistical learning would give you some insight about the closeness of empirical and expected quantities uniformly over some ball of neural networks, and this is how the ball is defined. Yeah, so how we got... We can run a procedure and then calculate these quantities, and typically they're not too small, so you know, for all we know, we can say that this is vacuous. Yes, Nati?
I just wanted to...
Sure, yeah.
It is true that, I mean, this is valid also with nonlinearities, but it's possible that in some sense it's more correct for linear networks.
That's right.
We're tighter for linear networks, and we're missing out on a lot of...
That's right, that's
correct. It could be much tighter, and we're missing out on that tightness.
That's right. Okay, so let me talk about the memory. Yes.
I have one question.
That's right. Yeah, that's a great question. So the question is, why are we trying to prove generalization bounds, the capital L of F hat minus L of F star? So there are several answers. One is to understand what is the complexity, what is the inherent difficulty of the problem, just to understand how complexity is related to the statistical properties of the problem. First, you observe a sample, you try to optimize something over a sample, but you get something good out of sample, and what is the complexity that, control of the complexity that allows you to make this step? So that's one answer. But the second answer is actually, typically these complexities can be used as penalties. You would then modify the procedure. You would penalize empirical loss plus a complexity, and then you would get some kind of adaptivity to the complexity of the result of the truth, right? So you, depending on whether the truth is, you would be able to prove that you can get there with the penalty, and roughly that's the idea. The method of sieves in statistics. Yeah, so here you can't. There are several different versions, and they're not necessarily comparable. So, yeah, we don't have necessarily a test for which one is better than another. Okay, so let me spend the remaining time on memorization, because I think this is an interesting topic, and maybe closer to what this workshop can help answer, maybe. Once again, this is the table with that shows lots of parameters for this relatively small 50K data set. The number of parameters is way more, and you still get a very good accuracy, or maybe you get good accuracy because there are so many parameters. what we discussed so far, this is from Nadia's paper, what we've just discussed so far is kind of, I would say, this regime, where the empirical quantities, the training quantity, and the black one, is close to the test, right? Because we try to prove uniformly over a class expected value is close to the empirical. And I want to stress that this cannot explain this part, and that's the most interesting part, in fact. In this regime, there is a perfect fit to data, so we can say that it memorizes the data, and the out-of-sample performance is not close, but it's not crazy high, right? There's another one. Okay, this is on 10 classes, so random guess would be 90%, but you get like 35%. This is very simple. This is by no means a state of the art, just to illustrate. And you get zero fit to data, that is zero in the sample, and reasonable out of sample. And this, I think, is a mystery, why this is happening. And uniform convergence cannot really explain this, because with uniform convergence, you would expect that this is close to, the empirical and expected are close, right? Does that make sense? So the question that people start asking is, and I like this line of research, is can a learning method be successful if it memorizes the training data? Because we always teach, with the tools that I just described, we always teach that you shouldn't memorize the data. You shouldn't fit the data exactly. That's a bad procedure. But in the last year, we started to revisit this assumption, something that I already talked about, linear separators with a margin is one example. You separate the data exactly, right? So we do have an example where it works fine, even though it separates the data exactly. But it's unsatisfying because that is also in the uniform convergence regime, because you can also show that the expected is close to zero. Not only the empirical fit to data is zero with the linear separator and the margin, but also the out of sample is close to zero, right? So again, we're in this regime, even though it's memorizing the data, it's still in this uniform convergence regime. So that's not satisfying. Let's consider an example of kernel ridge regression. So this is a problem where you minimize, I don't know if people can see it. Okay, let me just describe. You just fit, you work in a reproducing kernel Hilbert space with a kernel K, and you minimize over the whole space fit to data with a square loss, plus a penalty, which is the norm in the reproducing kernel Hilbert space squared with some parameter lambda, okay? That's the procedure, right? People are familiar with kernel ridge regression? It's just a nonlinear analog of the usual regression with the penalty, with a ridge, okay? Now, if you do experiments on MNIST, for instance, the out-of-sample performance only gets better and better as you decrease this parameter lambda, which is the penalty, the smoothness penalty for the solution. And in fact, for most of the pairs of digits, and this is for square loss, you get the best mean squared error at lambda equals to zero, without, when you don't have any penalty, right? But all the theory we have is with a penalty. It says that you have to add that regularization because there are too many solutions, you have to penalize the complexity of the problem and fit to data. Now, let me just say that when I say lambda is equal to zero, it is the minimal norm fit to data. So it's a particular choice of the interpolant through the data that is the minimal RKHS norm, minimal norm in that reproducing kernel Hilbert space.
So you said that you shouldn't use
In this example, not. So first of all, we can just invert the matrix here, and I mean there could be issues with machine precisions, but I don't think that's the case. And second, if you do gradient descent starting from zero, it actually converges to the minimal norm solution. So this one is a convex problem, and the gradient descent converges to the minimal norm. So that is the, I mean, it could be that there is some error how we get there when we stop, but I don't think so. Yeah, that's right. Here it's not. No, this is full gradient. You can just invert the matrix. Right. Okay. So this is actually not an isolated phenomenon. There are several papers showing now that you can fit the data exactly. You can memorize the data, and you can still do well out of sample. Right. So this is kind of I think the interesting conundrum. Maybe for this workshop.
In the previous slide, what sample size did you use? Because maybe for a low sample size, you need something
different. So 60,000 is the total for each pair. I guess it's, 6,000? So about, 3 minutes, okay.
Maybe if you use like 10, then you would get.
That's right. So if your data, we have some theory explaining this. It's probably not complete theory, but the results that we're proposing show implicit regularization in the regime where dimension of the input space is on the order of number of data points. So this is the high dimensional regime. And we have, okay, let me go after this. Okay, that's the minimal norm. I have 2 minutes left. Okay, so roughly speaking, we have a result that says that under a favorable properties of the design matrix X, which is the kind of a spectral decay of the correlation and the kernel matrices for the data, and high dimensionality of the data, so the regime here is the D is of the same order as N, and the curvature of the kernel, we use results about random matrices in that regime, the behavior of random matrices in the regime when random kernel matrices in the regime, to show that interpolation solution can generalize because of this implicit regularization due to the to these factors.
How curvature of the kernel is
this? Yeah, so we look at the kernel. This comes from a paper by El Karawi from Berkeley. We look at the paper G of, look at the kernel of this form, X, one x two over d, or the norm of the difference squared over d, and if the matrix, if the random matrix is defined this way, then properties of this function g, some curvature of this function g, is involved in essentially. Yes, yeah, so in terms of derivatives, 1 minute left, okay. There is some kind of implicit regularization happening. This gamma, this filtering of the eigenvalues comes from curvature of this G.
Okay.
Even though you interpolate the data. And that's to contrast with least squares, regularized least squares, where regularization, explicit regularization, provides a low-pass filter on the eigenvalues. So there's something happening with the high dimensionality that really helps you. And we have now evidence with a few more procedures that interpolation works in the high dimensional regime. Okay. This is a lower bound. This work with my student. We show that for a Laplace kernel, minimal norm interpolation cannot succeed for any choice of the bandwidth of the kernel. Cannot succeed in constant dimension d. So for low dimensional problems, interpolation doesn't work, but it seems to work in high dimensional problems. Yes?
Does this theory apply, does this theory apply to the case of quantum kitchen sinks? And,
so there you cannot enforce interpolation unless you, so I don't know what, exactly how you define the problem, but I don't know how you would force the interpolation. If you can show that it will interpolate if you take enough basis, then maybe.
So it must depend on the common projection.
Right? Yeah, that's right. I think there's a new paper just recently on exactly this that appeared on Archive by Misha Belkin. Okay, so that's it. Yeah, let me just stop here. And I had a few slides on what is overfitting. And let me just say that it's interesting that in every statistical book that you take, overfitting is conflated. There's a conflation between fitting the data too well and the model being too complex. And often these are put together, which is probably true in low dimensional situations. You shouldn't go through the data points. You should pull away from the data points. But it's not necessary to do so. And so it's actually unclear what overfitting is, right? It should be somehow related to the model being probably too complex, but it should not be related to fitting the data too well, right? Because you can have results with where overfitted models work very well, right? I can talk about this offline. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, I was pushing for this nice tutorial to get to a conclusion because we need to have time for discussion and have this different community to start to merge. So we have plenty of time for questions and we can take advantage from.
Maybe one can ask question, what is overfitting? Just
of course, one can.
This way bypass this question.
So that's the first question then.
Yes.
I think it's a vague notion, so.
But maybe just to have a look through a few slides.
Okay. I'm happy to do that, but if
of course I do allow, and if you can keep the explanation.
Yes. So look at the my favorite source, Wikipedia, right? So one explanation is overfitted model is a statistical model that contains too many contains more parameters that can be justified by the data, whatever that means, right? But then here somewhere it says, overfitting occurs when the model begins to memorize training data rather than learning to generalize from the trend. So these are two different things, right? And they should be kept separate. Perhaps this should be maybe one thrust for this workshop to try to get a better understanding of what is overfitting, right? So clearly we have models that fit the data perfectly and still generalize, right? So what are the different mechanisms for that? And you probably cannot use this uniform convergence regime that I just described before. But this is in every book, right? So you look at any book, it's a yellow book, so you know you can trust it. And the least squares estimate defined by minimizing the empirical L2, okay? Observe that it doesn't make sense to minimize overall functions because this may lead to a function that interpolates the data, hence not a reasonable estimate. Take this one. Okay, here's a more striking one. Training error consistently decreases with the model complexity, dropping to zero if we increase the model complexity enough. However, a model with zero training error is overfit to the training data and will not generalize poorly, right? So, I mean, it's clear that we teach this always, right? You shouldn't memorize the training data. You shouldn't pass through the training data. But some of the better results are obtained by these methods, yes.
So I completely agree with you that this when overfitting is good or when getting zero training error and having a large gap is good. But I'm curious, in these cases, it seems that you could also get the same, or maybe I should phrase this as a question. We should maybe distinguish in two situations. One in which by completely fitting the data, or overfitting, or whatever you call interpolating, you can get the same generalization, the same population error, as you would if you did the right thing, like if you actually balance things. Mm-hmm. And then the mystery is how come kind of things don't deteriorate as we fit better.
And I think
it seems like this is the most of the examples, at least, that you showed are of this nature. The question are the cases where you think that really the best performance, best performance, we have to have a large gap between the training and the test.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's wide open. I don't know. It is true that for the kernel case, small lambda still works fine. The emphasis there was, why does lambda equal to zero work at all? But getting a case where you have to interpolate somehow would be interesting. Yeah, I don't have any answers to this. Yeah. So here's another quote. This is actually a paper that claims that you should be interpolating, and maybe this is a good point, but a good segue. It's a paper which is quite interesting by Weiner et al. From UPenn. You cannot see the highlighting, but it says here, the common lore in statistical learning suggests that perfectly fitting the training data must inevitably lead to overfitting. This aversion is built into the DNA of a statistician, okay? Data can always be decomposed as signal and noise. And then he says, computer scientists has no dogmatic aversion to interpolating training data. And somehow this was the breakthrough. That's why computer science is just through, you know, big models, and it worked well, right? And so this paper doesn't have much theory, but it has some intuition why, for classification, interpolation is a good idea. So let's see. Yeah. So again, this is from that paper, so there's not much kind of theoretical explanation, but proof by picture, right? So these are minuses, these are pluses. If you're constrained to fit a linear model and you've got one noisy value, then the linear model will shift quite a bit. But if the model has enough flexibility to go out after that noisy example and come back, then it might just stick in place, right? That's kind of the intuition. There is no theoretical kind of justification for this.
So there is a question here. Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's a very naive one probably, but I mean, there's a knob, right, where you should be able to go from models that overfit and have overfitting errors to ones that overfit and don't. Can't we just tune that knob? Can't we just increase dimensionality systematically and see that it goes away to validate this hypothesis? That
in which model?
For
neural networks, it seems that you, people do report that at some point it goes up. If I don't know, if it's too large, the out of sample does go up. But there is definitely a large regime where increasing this knob, which is the number of parameters in this case, doesn't seem to.
Sure. So you should be able to systematically broaden that window where you do have no shooting up, right, by reducing your sample size or by whatever, and check that this is really what's happening.
I don't know. I think the study of the shape of this curve with respect to the Bayes variance trade-off is a really interesting kind of enterprise.
So there is a question there first.
Mm-hmm. So another way of rephrasing maybe his question is, so what is special about the class of function implemented by neural networks? I mean, you could think to other classes of function which you do observe overfitting. So do you have any rigorous results about this? I mean,
no. So the kernel case is the one where we have a closed form solution, so it's easy to have an interpolated solution in high dimension where we have all these knobs. That's where it started with the kernel, the study of the kernel regression. And there it seems that if you go to input dimension low, you do overfit, in the sense that you perform badly out of sample. So you fit, you go through the data, but you don't do well out of sample. You have a large mean squared error. But this goes away in high dimensional situations. And
so, for instance, I would expect that if you use kind of function like those using error correcting codes in high dimension, you should overfit because the scope of codes is exactly the opposite of generalization.
Mm-hmm. No? I don't know. I mean, all these results are definitely based on the fact that we can write down this function in a nice form and then analyze the bias and variance.
So if we start from the other limit, for small neural networks with, I don't know, a few thousand parameters where we can do the whole landscape properly, all the minimum transition states, all the landscapes that we've visualized are nice single funnels. And those local minima near the bottom generally have similar performance, although they misclassify differently. And I think the molecular analog is that because these networks are highly connected, they're effectively long range. And long range potentials in molecular science give simple landscapes. And if you start doing dropout and removing some of these weights, you can make the single funnel multi-funnel. And then it would be much harder to find the global minimum. So I think, I don't know how that will generalize to a million variables, but for a few thousand, it seems fairly clear that the neural network architecture gives simple, relatively simple single funnel landscapes that are relatively unfrustrated if you throw any of the usual frustration metric indices at them.
The question is about the empirical performance and the out of sample performance.
Yes, you can
so much. Okay. Yeah, so I don't know those.
In that case, there's if you give it enough training and testing data, it really doesn't make any difference. So,
I think the difficulty here is that you take a finite amount of data and then you take a model that's much larger.
Right. So this is the other limit.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure how relevant it is for the massively overfitted limit, but you can at least build it up and actually do the landscape. So it's the exact opposite, really, of not being able to find even a single local minimum. You can find everything.
That's right.
So certainly from that bottom up, it looks reasonably clear, but there's going to be a huge gap in between where we can't actually justify saying that these results will carry over. My guess is that they might.
I can't prove it.
So I have a question about, so one of your conclusion is that you say interpretation is good in very high dimension. So this could explain some of the empirical facts.
In some of the models, not
yeah.
This is so, not a blank
yeah,
statement.
My question is indeed, I mean, you doesn't seem to, so in principle, maybe there is also the kind of function that you want to interpolate that is important, meaning that, I don't know, images are some kind of function.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so right. Maybe, it's not just high dimension, it's also right. The kind of, let's say, data right. Input, output.
That's right. Let me just quickly describe two results, just to give you an intuition why in high dimensions, it's interpolation maybe doesn't hurt. So if you consider one nearest neighbor, right, so the prediction at the point is just to find the nearest neighbor in the data set and give that label, right? That is interpolating because at that point, that's your own neighbor. However, you cannot guarantee that this difference is small. And the Tom Cover result, the Hart from 67 is just to get an upper bound by 2 times the Bayes error. And that's pretty bad. If Bayes error is 10%, then there's an upper bound of 20%. It's not too good. However, if you go to more dimensions, you can consider k nearest neighbors, which is not interpolating. But if you slightly change it, and this is work by Belkin, Su, and Mitra, to be a simplicial interpolation. So here is 0, 0, and 1, and you, over this d-dimensional simplex, you just interpolate. compare this picture to the nearest neighbor picture. In the nearest neighbor picture, the region where the noise propagates is a sizable portion of the simplex. And in this case, it's a very tiny portion. So somehow, in high dimension, you don't pay, that cone has a small volume, you don't pay for that, if that's a noisy value, right? Does that make sense? Also, the lower bounds that we construct for maybe I can do it like this. The lower bounds we construct for kernel, why the kernel doesn't work here. Essentially, we assume that the function comes from some, let's say, Sobolev space. Now, you observe it in noise. So here's a noisy value. And now you put a combination of Laplace kernels, right? If the width of the kernel is wide, then you start going like that, and you pay for the L2 error here. You're not able to come back to the function to have a small L2 error. And if the width of the kernel is small, then you go like that, and then you pay here. But somehow this only works, this lower bound only works in low dimension. In high dimension, if you had a picture like this, then this volume, this L2 error, is small. So somehow it works in high dimension, but doesn't really work in low dimension. So we cannot do it for neural networks, but we can build toy models where it seems like high dimensionality is important. Whether high dimensionality is always important for interpolation, I don't think that's true. Actually, we have another result with Nadarai-Watson interpolation, and that works in any dimension, so, yeah.
Okay. Is there another quick question? Okay, if not, we are in good time for the coffee break. Thank Sasha for this great tutorial. Well, and see you back for the next session.